Good Morning Pensacola. Andrew McKay and the Pensacola Morning News starts right now.
Ago, my good friend Michelle Salzman gave me, I was on vacation, and I was at this house by the river. My good friend Michelle Salzman gave me a call, and she said, "Lucky, we need you to be the chairman of the board for Pensacola Navy Days." And I said, "What? I got a pretty busy life here." She said, no, wait a minute. We need you, and you won't have to do any work, and we need somebody who is good-looking, who looks like Errol Flynn and can stand in front of the audience and really present it well." Well, only one of those was true. It's up to you which one was true.
Of course, this was Tim Kinsella, Lucky, former commanding officer at NAS Pensacola before Village took over a couple of years ago. At the Navy Day celebration, the gala at the museum about a week and a half ago Friday, just kind of, you know, talking a little bit about the event. And the reason I wanted to let you hear this is because this was the setup to a speech, which was phenomenal and extraordinarily interesting and honestly significant. And that's why I'm covering it this morning. I just hadn't had a chance to get the audio cut up for you until now. But we'll get to that in just a second. Lucky's intro to the speech by Admiral Harry Harris is just kind of, you know, I mean, as entertaining and worth mentioning.
Why are we doing Pensacola? Why are we doing Pensacola Navy Days? And why is it called Pensacola Navy Days? The Naval Aviation Museum isn't in Cincinnati. It's in Pensacola. There's a reason why it's here.
Absolutely, there's a reason why it's here.
The Navy's been here almost 200 years. It has to be Pensacola Navy Days. Is it just about the Navy? No, it's not. It's about all of the services. It's about all of the men and women that are in uniform that pass through these gates that decide to call Pensacola their home. It's about all of them. It's about their families. But we're a Navy town, aren't we? Aren't we a Navy town? Yeah, we are.
That is the heart of it. Town of Naval Aviation in particular. So that was just kind of, you know, tone setter for you from the gala. And then Admiral Harry Harris got up to speak, and I didn't really know what we were in for. I didn't know him particularly, you know, or know much about him. Somewhat significant military figure, 40-year career in uniform, which is 40. Okay, that's quite a bit. He was trained and graduated, designated a naval flight officer in 1979, an NFO, a backseater, a goose, if you want to think of it that way, from Top Gun. He did an okay job in the military. He was, commander of U.S. Indo-PACOM, Pacific Command. He also wound up being the 23rd ambassador to South Korea. And he was a retired four-star. So, you know, there's 1 stars, 2 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars. There are no 5 stars right now. I believe the rule is you only have a 5-star when you're actively at war. So 4 is as many as you can get. There's only been about 200 4-stars in the entire history of the Navy. So, you know, significant rank, okay? And he got up and gave a speech, and this speech was, to me, this was a overview of what could have easily been a seminar in foreign relations, and nobody's really covered it because I don't think anybody was really recording it except for me, you know, but that's what I do. I record everything all the time. And he started with just kind of the introductions that he actually was inspired to join the Navy when Chappie James came and spoke to his school.
Chappie James was an alum of Washington High School, and one day in 1970, he came to Booker T to address the student body. I was just a freshman then, and he was a brand new 1-star. So we were all awed by him, of course. He stood in the middle of the basketball court, and the students were all in the bleachers. Well, he said something to the effect that if he could general, so could we. And I believe that he spoke directly to me. Of course he didn't, but to my dying day, I choose to believe that he did.
So, you know how some people become naval aviators because they see the Blue Angels. He became a naval aviator because he saw Chappie James.
This is a fitting venue indeed for me to share with you my thoughts on those threats and the importance of the Indo-Pacific region through the twin lenses of having commanded the Indo-Pacific Command and as your ambassador to South Korea.
So he's going to give a foreign policy speech. And he did give a foreign policy speech. And, of course, this is central to the question of American military power, naval aviation, the ability to project force around the world and keep the peace and maintain the international diplomatic order, which is what we've been doing basically ever since World War II.
So, point blank, I believe in 2024, we're at an inflection point in history. We're certainly not near anything resembling the end of history. Freedom, justice, and the rules-based system hang in the balance, and the scale won't tip of its own simply because of wishful thinking.
Now, you may not get that reference that he's making when he says, I certainly believe we're not at the end of history, because that is a very particular phraseology. He's referring to this theory that was put forward by a guy named Francis Fukuyama back in, late 80s, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War. And, the theory at that time was democracy won. You know, the Soviets would convert over. They would become, they would disband, which they did, and they would become a peaceful collection of former satellite states and a main nation in Russia. And, they would basically pursue open, free, competitive democracy and economic capitalism, just like we had. We won. Communism is dead. It's all over. The Chinese will fall in line. Everybody will fall in line. That was the idea, was, hey, let's manage the future prosperity. And, he says, yeah, I don't think it happened that way. But that was, I remember being taught this figure, this concept. I think it was a paper that eventually became a book by Francis Fukuyama. But, I remember learning about that when I was in political science in college. And, yeah, it did not manifest, right, in the long run. So now what do we do?
So let's do this. Here are my dozen wave talks. Number one, President Reagan once said that we cannot play innocence abroad in a world that's not innocent. This statement is as true today as it was in 1941, throughout the Cold War, on 9/11, on the 24th of February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, and the 7th of October last year when Hamas attacked Israel. The world remains a dangerous place. The unipolar moment following the Cold War is over. Two, the U.S. has enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific, a region at a precarious crossroad where tangible opportunity meets significant challenge.
We can't be innocent about the nature of the world around us, and that, one global superpower moment that did exist for a little while is certainly no longer the case. And as you heard him talk about, all of the different major international events and conflicts going on right now, things have gone from being okay and you couldn't be too worried to being very worried about a wide variety of international threats.
Since the beginning of this century, the situation has worsened in almost every geostrategic measure. Consider that North Korea has tested nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them to our very shores. Consider that Taiwan is under siege. Israel finds itself fighting once again for its very existence. Ukraine is ablaze. Eastern and Northern Europe are under a threat. And your Navy is involved in countering Houthi rebels who have effectively shut down commercial shipping in the Red Sea.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture. I know Americans are not particularly great at paying attention to international affairs, things that actually happen in other countries, let alone when there are major conflicts. And just basic stuff like understanding the geography. The average American, sadly, is going to have a hard time placing places like Yemen on a map. It's the Middle East, right? Isn't it in the Middle East somewhere? Is that near Greece? No. No, not really. Sort of, but no, not really. Is it close to Pakistan? No. A little bit, but no, not really. Americans are just not good at this, and so he's taking some time to really, he's not going to give you a geography lesson. Might have been useful, frankly, but, he's talking about how this stuff is really serious. We need to pay attention.
The Biden administration's national security strategy underscores America's vital interests in the Indo-Pacific region that's open, interconnected, prosperous, secure, and resilient. Though I would use the term adversary rather than competitor, this strategy recognizes that the PRC is the only competitor with both the intent and increasingly the capability to reshape the international order. It emphasizes that America's single greatest asymmetric strength is our network of alliances and partnerships.
And that's a really important point that, you know, the Biden administration, which is continuing a tradition being maintained by prior administrations going back decades, works to build diplomatic relationships with our allies, because we're not going to be able to do this alone. And getting all of these other teammates on our side, continuing to maintain them on our side, recruiting them to our side, that is long term. That is the key goal. And then he spent, you know, extended time talking about our most compelling threats, the ones that we need to really be watching. North Korea, PRC, People Republic of China. Okay, you might hear him occasionally acronymize these things. But North Korea, major adversary that we have to be thinking seriously about.
Why is North Korea so far away in Northeast Asia a challenge for the entire world? Well, the answer is simple. Kim Jong-un's missiles point in every direction. Today, North Korea stands out as the only country this century to have tested nuclear weapons. North Korea is ruled with an iron fist by a brutal dictator who values power over the prosperity and welfare of his own people.
Basic underlying philosophy of North Korea is problematic, and their, obviously, possession of nuclear weapons and their possession of missiles to deliver them in all directions makes them a universal international threat. That's why we need to be paying attention.
The North's unrelenting pursuit of nuclear weapons, the means to deliver them, and its unmitigated aggression towards South Korea and America should concern us all.
But it's worse than that. It's those are things that I think the average American might know. Might know North Korea's got nukes. Might know that they're not interested in playing ball in a good way. Might, I mean, you know, but certainly people who pay attention, that stuff's kind of well known. It's worse than that.
I believe the KJU wants four things. Sanctions relief, to keep us nukes.
KJU's Kim Jong-un, by the way.
To split our alliance and to dominate the peninsula. Last September, he stated unequivocally that he'd never give up his nukes, and the North Korea status as a nuclear weapon state is irreversible. Last January, by declaring that the North would no longer seek peaceful reunification with the South, he abandoned a foundational doctrine of the communist regime. And now he's trading low-cost weapons for Russian technology. Why am I not surprised? None of this sounds like he's going to get rid of his nuclear weapons anytime soon. In fact, he's telling us precisely the opposite.
It's a fantasy to think that he's going to be willing to give up his nukes voluntarily, even in exchange for carrots or in response to sticks. That announcement that they're not, you know, or that assessment that they are not interested in, an announcement that they're not interested in reunification with the South, that they don't care to rejoin South and North Korea, it wasn't all that likely to happen, but it was kind of like the end state that we all pretended might eventually take place. And they're not even pretending anymore.
Now, while we hope for diplomacy with North Korea to be successful, we must recognize that hope alone is not a course of action. The quest for dialogue with the North must never be made at the expense of the ability to respond to threats from the North. Dialogue and military readiness must go hand in hand. Idealism must be rooted in realism.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been sort of core basic American policy for forever that, you know, look, it's not going to work, but we need to keep trying. Talking is better than shooting. But you have to always be prepared to shoot. You have to always be investing in military capability. You have to always be looking toward that possibility, right? That is sadly always the case. Have to prepare for that.
By his declarations and actions, KJU has eliminated any remaining fantasy about the potential peaceful reunification with South Korea. Let's not sugarcoat his words, ladies and gentlemen. Let's take them at face value. I believe our heretofore U.S. policy goal of negotiating away North Korea's nuclear program has reached its useful end. We must upper combined game. Deterrence by appeasement is not deterrence at all.
Deterrence by appeasement is not deterrence at all. And a recognition that Kim Jong-un will not voluntarily part company with his nuclear weapons, that he is not interested in long-term peace or the reunification with South Korea, that he is actively cooperating with Russia, trading arms for technology. These are all very concerning things, and changing our understanding of what's going on in Asia and being honest with ourselves about what's going on in that part of the world is vital. And so this was just part one. This was quite a good, I mean, this was, I think, about a 40-minute speech, if I remember correctly. And, you know, I wanted to go through it today with you a little bit, and I will post the actual entire speech up on our Facebook page. I'll podcast it for you eventually. But wanted to kind of walk through this with you because, you know, when a retired four-star who used to command the Indo-Pacific Command comes to speak in Pensacola at the museum to a public group, you should take notice and pay attention. And so here I am. I'm trying to take notice and pay attention. 525, that's Admiral Harry Harris, retired at the Navy Days Gala about a week and a half ago Friday. Just haven't had a chance to get to this until now, and I knew that it would probably stick around for a week as news, which, of course, it has, as other things tended to get in the way over the course of the last week or so. 525 on News Radio Pensacola. I'm Andrew McKay.
Matter number six, and that's the elephant in this room and in all rooms, and that's China. As you all know well, there are very few bipartisan issues in Washington these days, but our national concern about the PRC is one of them. To be clear, the U.S. has partnered well with China on several important fronts, but Washington and Beijing fundamentally disagree on how to approach the current international order. The PRC simply does not keep its word, from its treaty with the British on Hong Kong to its human rights abuses against the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, and others, to commercial espionage and the weaponization of debt, and to its quest to intimidate, isolate, and dominate Taiwan.
Dealing honestly, holding yourself accountable, believing in standards, telling the truth, following the things that you vote on and agree to in terms of international agreements, that's stuff that we believe in the West. That is not stuff that China believes in. That is part of the challenge of dealing with them, is that they will not follow through on what the rest of us believe are essentially constraints on our activities as international actors. This is Admiral Harry Harris, now retired, speaking at Navy Days about a week and a half ago. Outstanding speech on foreign policy. Four-star admiral comes to town. We're going to report on it, what he talked about. If you want to, we're going to podcast all of these together as one entity, so all of my coverage, and also I'll podcast the raw speech so you can listen to it for yourself. Talked extensively about North Korea and about China at the home of, you know, the cradle of naval aviation, the Naval Aviation Museum during Navy Days, and understanding why it's important for citizens to know what's going on in the world so that we can properly understand, you know, why the military matters, why what our politicians do with the military matters, and why we need to be paying attention to these things, because ultimately it is up to all of us to shape in a democratic system, to shape the policy through the people that we elect or the demands that we make on the people that we elect, what they do when it comes to dealing with somebody like China.
Secretary Austin testified that he's focused on the threat posed by the PRC, and he promised strong support for Taiwan. I, for one, was glad to see President Biden meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in San Francisco on the margins of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit last November. Churchill said that it's better to jaw, jaw, jaw than shoot, shoot, shoot. However, as with North Korea, idealism must be rooted in realism. Just consider Beijing's clear support for Russia, for North Korea, for Iran, for Syria, and for the Taliban. I'm an advocate for reinforcing diplomacy with hard power when dealing with Beijing.
Yeah, because, again, they will talk until they can shoot, 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 as we understand is the intended outcome in Taiwan, their buildup of their navy, their acquisition and their fabrication of islands in the South China Sea that they could then acquire and use as outpost bases and interfere with, you know, flow of traffic in the sea. I mean, all of this stuff, right? So being realistic about the Chinese threat, especially when it comes to Taiwan.
Now, this brings me to number seven, and this is Taiwan. Look, Taiwan is democratic, an idea factory, and a global force for good, despite the PRC's unrelenting quest to destroy it or to absorb it. I've called for ending the U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity in favor of strategic clarity.
Now, you may or may not be familiar with that concept of strategic ambiguity. It has been the United States policy for quite some time. The basic gist of it is this: Taiwan is independent, but China does not agree that they're independent. China believes that Taiwan belongs to them. And in America, we have taken this policy of we support Taiwan, but we don't recognize Taiwan. And we believe that they are independent, but we do not say that they're independent. And it's very weird, but it is the policy of strategic ambiguity in the sense that, you know, yes, we will definitely help defend you against China if they invade you. but we will not necessarily definitely recognize you as an independent entity that is justified in asking for help defending against the motherland that owns you and believes that they own you anyway. If you're confused, good. Welcome to the party. But that's what we've been doing for years and years and years. And he says we should stop that policy. I agree. That's a policy that it was nuts to begin with, and it has become even less tenable over the years.
Indo-Pacific strategy that I mentioned earlier specifically supports an environment in which Taiwan's future is determined peacefully by the Taiwanese. What a concept. Unlike our policy of strategic ambiguity, the PRC's intent is crystal clear. We must never allow China to dictate our policy toward Taiwan.
See, the idea of strategic ambiguity was if they're not clear, if they're ambiguous, we could allow them to promote this fantasy that they owned Taiwan and it was their right to take it if they wanted to, as long as they weren't actually going to do it. Now that it looks like they're actually going to do it, or very, very likely to actually do it, then we can't really take the policy of saying, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, right? We have to do something and take seriously this prospect.
Successor and Indo-Pacific Command testified before Congress in 2021 that the PRC could invade Taiwan in 6 years. That's 2027. We ignore Admiral Davidson's warning at our peril.
Admiral Davidson took over command of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, which he was the commanding officer for before he retired and before he became an ambassador to South Korea. Take this seriously. Believe it. It's on the near horizon within the next couple of years. They could certainly have the military capability to at least give it a try. As their naval power is increasing, our naval power is decreasing because of long-time failures to maintain shipyards and shipbuilding, to maintain a fleet, to really prepare for the possibility of future, kinetic conflict with various foreign powers. Yes, we have the strongest military in the world, but we have not been doing what really needs to be done to maintain that properly over the years. And there's a whole variety of reasons why, but it's a challenge. Now, we're not weak, but we don't have the level of overwhelming, convincing, deterrent capability that you'd like to have to keep somebody like China from invading Taiwan. And that's what you'd prefer to have. Again, there are not very many 4-stars in the history of the country, like 200-ish, 230. So when one comes to town, you talk about it. Okay, this is actually pretty significant news that he came and gave this speech. Again, at Navy Day, about a week and a half ago. He talked about a bunch of other things, including the Quad Agreement, U.S., Australia, India, Japan. This is not a mutual defense agreement. This is just that we're all interested in the same kinds of things. Let's work together, and you can add more parties to the agreement. It doesn't have to be just four as a quad. And, Big Ten can be 14. Why not? Then, why can't the quad be more than four? And, again, it's not a defense pact. It's not NATO. But it is something to be aware of. And also another one, AUKUS, is another term you might hear occasionally. Not very likely because, unfortunately, American news media is not great at reporting on international affairs and keeping the American people educated. Is that a result of people not caring and so they respond to that, or that they don't do their job and so people don't care? Well, it's both. You get the politicians you deserve, you get the media you deserve. Sobering, but true. The U.S., Australia, and the United Kingdom all working together, and the, that's AUKUS, AUKUS, Australia, UK, US. And then the idea that Australia may in the next year or two launch their own nuclear submarine, which is, kind of exciting news to imagine that possibility. Then he talked about Russia. And in order to understand what he thinks about China, why what he thinks about China is so important, and its relationship with North Korea, you have to understand what's going on in Russia. And, man, this is both the most concerning and the most sobering thing to think about, all right? So the invasion of Ukraine, massively important to understand.
Just spend a few minutes on Russia and Ukraine by first acknowledging the unconscionable human tragedy that's being perpetuated by Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine. Moscow seeks to pressurize, terrorize, and pulverize Kyiv. As Garry Kasparov said, Russia is committing war crimes on an industrial scale in Ukraine.
If you're not old enough, you may not recognize the name Garry Kasparov. He was a chess champion, who American citizen now, but he has been very, very, that's right. God, all of a sudden, you know, say something on the air and you hope it's right. I believe that's true. Anyway, but he has been very, very critical of Vladimir Putin, a brilliant man. And, you know, yeah, I mean, Vladimir Putin is committing war crimes on an industrial scale. That's an accurate description of what's going on in Ukraine.
So why does Ukraine matter at all? Well, consider that Ukraine is a democracy and the second largest country in Europe after Russia. Consider that Ukraine sent forces to Afghanistan in support of NATO, even though it's not in NATO. Consider that Ukraine sent troops to Iraq, where they fought and died for coalition objectives. And remember, in 1994, Kyiv voluntarily gave up its nuclear weapons at the behest of the West.
Now, there's a whole conversation to be had about what exactly they gave up back then, but that's true. They gave up the possession of former Soviet nuclear weapons when the Soviet Empire collapsed. And they gave them up in exchange for the promise by the West that we would protect them. And we didn't. Period. I mean, you know, we've helped. But I don't think our help is at the level that Ukraine kind of expected when they gave up those nuclear weapons. I looked up Garry Kasparov, Croatian citizenship, not U.S. citizenship at this point. Former Russian, of course, Soviet. Anyway, so why Ukraine matters? Because, you know, they've done very, very good things over history. Helping us. They've also, they're the biggest country other than Russia in Europe, right?
So why did Russia invade Ukraine at all? Two words, Vladimir Putin. Maya Angelou once said that when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. Folks, time and time again, Putin has shown us who he is, and shame on us if we fail to believe him. In my opinion, he seeks to rebuild the former Soviet Union, not under communism, but to its old borders. You could call it neo-imperialism, revanchism, if you will.
So revanchism just means kind of getting back what was you're entitled to, you know, restoring a retribution for, you know, things inflicted upon you. But yeah, imperialism, revanchism, restoration of the Soviet Union, all things that you certainly have to believe Vladimir Putin believes in and wants to accomplish in his, you know, relatively quickly diminishing lifespan, right? He's, you know, what, 70, I think, right now?
So Kazakhstan, Georgia, Moldova, of course, Ukraine, and many others are at risk. Poland and the Baltics, too, but they're a part of NATO, and that's a different nut for Putin to crack. But if we don't support NATO, those nutshells begin to look like eggshells.
Yeah, if you don't have clear, solid deterrence, he'll keep going. You remember how it happened in the 40s? Well, in the 30s. I mean, it's not the first time that somebody needed to be taught a lesson, and when you don't teach them a lesson, you keep appeasing or you keep turning a blind eye or you keep saying that's not really our problem. You know, whether it's Georgia or Croatia or now Ukraine, you know, he believes it all belongs to him. He doesn't believe he's invading. He believes he's taking back what rightly belongs to him and the former Soviet Union. And, you know, we have to believe and act differently.
And why 2022? In my opinion, opportunism. Putin saw the West as weak, distracted by the pandemic. He saw America's political divisions play out in Washington, and he watched our endgame in Afghanistan. But he miscalculated, and stunningly so. He underestimated Ukraine's resolve. He might not believe that Ukraine is independent, but the Ukrainians sure do, and they're willing to fight and die for their country. He underestimated the former comedian and everyman who became the president of Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky has risen to his office in truly Churchillian fashion. He underestimated the resolve of the international community to undermine Russia's economic backbone.
So Putin miscalculated, as people have done over history, believing that we were weak, believing that we wouldn't act, believing that we were distracted and couldn't handle COVID and war, too. But he'd underestimated Zelensky. It's true. Former actor, comedian. It's crazy that this is the guy who's running the country and doing it so well in a wartime defense footing. But we miscalculated, too.
Now, while Yale School of Management concluded that over 1,000 companies have curtailed operations in Russia, and some even predicted that Russia was headed for economic oblivion, 2 years on, we know that these assessments were premature. Russia has rebounded by turning its economy into a war footing, and finding new international export partners, especially in energy.
Yeah. You know, we thought Russia would collapse when that first push into Kyiv failed because it showed that they could not handle logistics around their military aggression. They didn't understand combined arms. They didn't understand how to really use their forces. We thought they were this, you know, massive capability force, and it turns out they really weren't. And we thought they would collapse, their people might revolt, their economy couldn't handle it, and Russia would be done soon. Well, 2 years in, they're not done. They're strengthening.
On the other hand, Putin overestimated his own strategy, a fantasy of his own making, that he could blitzkrieg Ukraine in 15 days. It's been well over 2 years now. Now, what we're seeing playing out on the battlefield are poorly trained troops led by some very bad generals. And I'll just note for the record that there are a few things that admirals like better than criticizing generals. Without adequate enabling logistics and no understanding of combined arms. Numbers are uncertain at best, but I've seen reporting that in over 2 years of hard fighting, Russia has lost has suffered over 315,000 casualties, lost thousands of tanks and armored fighting vehicles, hundreds of aircraft, and according to the New York Times, 12 general officers.
That's a lot. It's not quite as much as we lost in World War II, but that was a, you know, 4 years engagement for us, right? So 315,000 dead, 1,000 tanks, 100 air, and a dozen general officers or more is a lot. And there are problems with the Russian military, problems that the Chinese have to be watching. And we'll talk about that when we finish up my analysis of this coming up at 7 o'clock. But again, this speech given by Admiral Harry Harris, 4-star retired U.S. former ambassador to South Korea and commander of the Indo-Pacific Command. Very important speech here in Pensacola. When a 4-star talks, you listen, even a former 4-star. So that's why I wanted to report on this morning.
See Ukraine pressurized by the war of attrition that Moscow is waging against Kyiv. I see America's continued support to Ukraine challenged by those political divisions I spoke about in Washington. But I believe that Ukraine can still win, but they need our significant help. Russia has a plan to achieve its end state. Do we? Paraphrasing Ann Applebaum's recent article in The Atlantic, is the U.S. really going to abandon Ukraine now after we rallied the world to help the Ukrainians? In my opinion, to do otherwise would be strategic folly.
So this is a speech. If you've been listening to the show this morning, you know. And if you haven't been, I understand, because, you know, most people don't necessarily listen to the whole 4 hours. I get it. But for Navy Days, about a week and a half ago, for the gala at the Naval Aviation Museum on board NAS Pensacola, the guest speaker, the keynote speaker, was Admiral Harry Harris, 4-star retired. 4 stars. Okay. That's a big deal. That's the highest rank you can get in the Navy outside of wartime when you might have a 5-star admiral. But, you know, 4-star admiral is pretty big deal. He was the commander of Indo-Pacific Command. He was commander of U.S. Pacific Fleet. He was the ambassador to South Korea after he was in office, or after he was in the military. 40 years in the military, pretty good. And he gave a speech about foreign policy and the importance of naval air power, which of course originates here in Pensacola, and generally understanding the military strategic significance of what's going on in Ukraine, of Israel, of Russia, of China. And it was quite a keynote speech, frankly, and I hadn't had a chance to cover it until now. Very, very interesting stuff. I will podcast the whole speech for you on our podcast page eventually. But I want to share this with you because he's right. You know, what was going on with Russia in Ukraine, you know, we talked everybody into helping defend Ukraine, and now some people in America and in Congress are unsure whether we should keep helping Ukraine against Russia. I have said before, and I'll say again, I think we absolutely should. You know, thank God the French helped us in the revolution. You know, thank God. And I view it as largely similar. You know, don't give up now. This is a great way for us to, you know, fight our adversary without having to fight our adversary directly. We can indirectly fund and train, and then we don't have to fight them, okay? And we can, you know, degrade the Russian capability and make it harder so Vladimir Putin can reestablish the Soviet Empire. But the reason he talked a lot about Russia was so we understand Russia, but then so we understand why this is relevant to China. Okay, kind of all the conversation I've been having about this speech so far is sort of built up to this. Why does Russia matter so much for China and the People's Republic of China, PRC?
Hard to say where Beijing will land, but Xi Jinping is no fool. He craves stability in the international order so that he has time to shape that order to his favor. The very things that he seeks to weaken, the West, the U.S., the U.N., our alliances with Japan, South Korea, Australia, and the Philippines, have come together with Ukraine as a catalyst. While supportive of Russia, the PRC is not yet all in on Russia. However, in my opinion, Beijing is moving in that direction.
This is really important to understand if you want to understand global politics, okay? Russia, right, thought that it would destabilize the West, thought that we would cave and collapse, and they'd take back Ukraine, and that'd be their third notch in Vladimir Putin's belt after Georgia and Crimea, which, of course, is kind of part of Ukraine anyway. They miscalculated. You know, Russia miscalculated, okay? What they thought would happen was that, you know, we would all kind of fall apart and fracture. You know, the West is weak and the alliances are weak. And what it actually did was it united us in opposition and brought us together and actually have brought now more people into NATO. Well, that's something that China's been watching, obviously.
You can be assured that Xi Jinping is watching Ukraine closely and learning. He's learning that control of the internet is vital. He's learning that drones have changed the nature of war. Unfortunately, he's also learning that the West's staying power is somewhere between 2 and 3 years. But I believe he's also wondering. He's wondering how his military, untested in sustained combat operations since the Korean War, would fare in modern 21st century warfare.
Yeah, because he's watching Russia completely fail. Or not completely, but fail greatly compared to what we expected them to be able to do. And the other, you know, that's a bit surprising. Learning about drones, learning about, I mean, all kinds of things that he is learning from seeing what's happening in Ukraine.
He's wondering if his army, trained in the Soviet model, is as bad as Russia's appears to be. If his generals and admirals, again, trained in the Soviet model, are as inept as Russia's appears to be. And if his vaunted Navy, the PLA Navy, is as vulnerable as the Black Sea Fleet is.
Yeah, because they, you know, he, like the Russians, believe that they're very, very, very strong and capable. Well, look what happened to the Russians. Is that a sobering lesson for us as the Chinese? And that's kind of what Admiral Harris was getting at in that part of the speech. So, in a weird way, the invasion of Ukraine either might talk Xi Jinping out of aggression, out of the fear that what he's got is a paper tiger. Then again, it might also talk him into engaging in activity that would reform and strengthen and build up an actual strong enough army because he sees how it was vulnerable and could be a problem for him if he decides to go against Taiwan. Like, you could sort of see it either way.